1.
This is Diane Gold, and we are at peace. We actively are pursuing peaceful and sustainable solutions for the planet through healthy and ethical choices in nutrition, personal discipline, mind-body lifestyle, and kindness to all living things. That's the big one. We talk about issues in health and peacemaking, interviewing change makers in the fields of health and wellness, nutrition, all the medicines, that's meaning Eastern, Western, Ayurvedic, tribal, ethnobotanical, and if I have left any out, yours is in there too, therapies, disciplines, fitness, social justice, human and animal rights, and people who are passionate on behalf of themselves and others to create solutions that help all of us enjoy a higher quality of life. So today we have Bill Douglas, co-founder of World Tai Chi Day and Qigong Day, an author, a teacher, and my friend. He has impacted the world by getting hundreds of thousands of people to do the same body-mind disciplines at the same time throughout the world, all at once. That's pretty spectacular. It's been happening for 16 years. And Bill is also an author. His book, Spreading a Message of Peace and Compassion, through intricately woven suspense plots, as well as nonfiction. He also has the largest global directory of teachers and practitioners of Tai Chi and Qigong, and that is on the World Tai Chi website. All right, so I would like to welcome Bill Douglas. How are you, Bill? So
I'm good, Diane. So good to talk to you.
Yeah, so happy that you are here. This is really great. Now, why don't we begin with you telling us what World Tai Chi and Qigong Day is and what it does.
Okay, well, on the last Saturday of April every year, in about 80 countries, people hold these events. It starts at 10 a.m. In the earliest time zones, which is sometimes New Zealand, sometimes Samoa. And what they do is they hold mass Tai Chi and Qigong exhibitions and teach-ins that the public is invited to participate in, and then they do a lot of media work around it as well. So oftentimes the media covers these things around the world, and then it spreads from time zone to time zone across the planet as the planet turns. So it's 10 a.m. local time all over the planet, and so the final event is in Kauai, Hawaii, so it spreads with these events all across Asia and Europe and North and South America. And the motto of the event is One World, One Breath. And the initial impetus for the event was to use it as a mass public education event to educate people about the mounting research on Tai Chi and Qigong. Harvard Medical School, or Harvard Health publications called Tai Chi Medication in Motion for all the myriad health issues that it can benefit or even treat. And so we've gotten coverage from CNN and BBC Television and Associated Press Television and, you know, major media throughout the planet, and used it as a health education vehicle in that way so that millions of people could be educated on these health benefits that they probably weren't aware of. And but over time, it's kind of, you know, like with your, when people start practicing mind-body practices like Tai Chi or Qigong or meditation, they tend to start with one reason. Usually it's for like health or stress or something like that. And but then over time, as they go through the process of learning these practices, it's like their practice starts to evolve and become more. Like, for example, I started teaching a lot of hospital classes over a decade ago. And so a lot of people, like I had an emergency room physician, and they were coming because they were, you know, dealing with a health issue or stress or whatever. And the classes helped with that. But then what they also found was that their spouses and their coworkers found them much, much more pleasant to be around. And so it became kind of a psycho-spiritual journey where they actually became better people. They didn't just heal that particular physical thing, but they began to become better people. And so World Tai Chi and Qigong Day has kind of gone through that evolution as well, because what you start to realize as you look at the videos and the photos from people all around the planet practicing these mind-body techniques together on the same day, is you start to see the commonality of humanity. you start to see that, you know, different people, different religions, different ethnicity, different geopolitical boundaries, they all have that same look on their face when they delve into that, you know, that kind of inner experience that you get when you practice these things. And there was just something so profound about that, that it kind of evolved World Tai Chi and Qigong Day beyond just being a health education event, which it is, into also being a way to kind of connect human beings all across the planet, and to be able to see the commonality of humanity and how we're all kind of dealing with the same things, you know, stress and all these kind of things. And so it became something kind of a global healing connection of people all across the planet. And then it, eventually it adopted the motto of One World, One Breath.
That's great. That's great. So now on the website, at worldtaichiday.org, you have one of the biggest repositories for what the health benefits are. And, you know, there are and articles, medical journal references. What are the different diseases that Tai Chi targets?
Well, the Harvard Medical School Guide to Tai Chi by Dr. Peter Wayne just came out a couple of years ago, and they put together a lot of the research, not all of it, but a lot of it, and heart disease was one of the things that they showed studies on that Tai Chi has been shown to benefit. It's recommended for fibromyalgia, MS, Parkinson's. Stress, you know, anxiety, depression, mood disturbance, all those kind of things. And then also there's research that shows that it heals the DNA. The DNA tends to get damaged from stress. And so these types of techniques heal the telomeres that get frazzled on the ends of the DNA. And so it actually heals the DNA and changes the DNA. And then also there's been studies at UCLA and also European studies that showed that it boosted the immune system's function between 50 and 100%, which is really mind-boggling. I mean,
totally.
If there was a drug that could, if there was a drug that could boost your helper T cell count by 100%, you know, you'd be hearing about it, you know, constantly on television. But with Tai Chi and Qigong, you don't, because with Tai Chi, nobody's making billions of dollars off Tai Chi. It's very labor-intensive. Process, which is actually good for the economy, you know, it employs a lot of people, but at the same time, nobody amasses massive fortunes, so you don't have constant TV commercials about it, even though it does these amazing things. But when you really get down to it, when you boil it down to its bouillabaisse or its essence, the thing about most modern health problems that aren't accident-related are caused by stress. Kaiser Permanente did a 20-year study years ago, and they found that they determined that about 70% of all the health problems that people have that send patients to their doctors that aren't accident related are caused by stress. And I actually called after I read the article, the research report. I called Kaiser Permanente and I contacted Dr. David Sobel at Kaiser, and he said that number could go as high as 85%, depending on how you looked at the numbers. And so between 70 and 85%. Of all non-accident related illness is caused by stress. And
that's
so,
crazy.
You know,
wow.
Yeah. So these mind-body techniques, I mean, they have the potential of literally saving, trillions of dollars, because we spend about $2.5 trillion a year, I think, on healthcare just in the United States. And so we're talking about, you know, over time, trillions of dollars of savings if we started integrating these things into public school and corporate wellness and, you know, senior care and, you know, at all levels of society.
So what kind of, how could we get physicians to recommend this type of training if, as you said, it's going to reduce the amount of money that people are going to be spending, because people are going to be getting better without taking drugs or without doing certain kinds of protocols where they have to spend money on Western medicine?
Right. Well, we've spent I teach primarily here in the Kansas City area, although I've done presentations all over the world. But over the years I've worked with a lot of health centers and health institutions, and recently I started teaching for the state University Hospital, and also through the State Medical Center, University Medical Center. And we've started programs with Tai Chi and Qigong meditation for a whole bunch of different health challenges that people are dealing with. So we actually get referrals from physicians for our classes now, and that's a huge breakthrough. It's taken us years to get there. And so, like, we have a class for people dealing with heart disease. We have a class for people dealing with chronic pain, for MS, for Parkinson's, and so on and so forth. And so we've had huge breakthroughs where we're actually getting people referred to these classes, and they're funded through donations and you know, it's a state program as well. And so they're free to the public. Now I get paid as a teacher, you know, that's
through
the funding, but they're open to anybody in the public. And so really, Kansas City's kind of created a model for the world. And so
that's what I was going to say. That's amazing. So you've created the business model that that we could look to have that done wherever we are.
That's correct. And if people go to worldtaichiday.org and get on our they can join our free email mailing list. We do like a weekly e-zine, all things Tai Chi and Qigong. And so we alert people about the medical research, emerging medical research on Tai Chi and Qigong. But we also give people step-by-step how-to instructions on how we did this here in Kansas City, so that teachers all over the planet, or even enthusiasts, can get help their teachers replicate what we've done here all over the planet. And
this is very fascinating to me. I definitely want to talk more with you about this model, and I would like to make sure that this model gets more publicity, because that's huge. Good job. Fantastic. So how did you think about getting all of us collectively together doing this? How did you think that up?
Well, there was a kind of a whole bunch of things that kind of converged around this, you know, looking back over the decades. I think the big thing that's kind of got me started on it was when the physicians that were in my classes started seeing all these amazing health benefits, and they started doing data research mining on their hospital databases and then handing me the medical research. And I was seeing all this amazing medical research, and I started getting frustrated because I wasn't seeing it reported in the media. And so now another thing that happened was a personal thing that had happened years before when I first started learning Tai Chi, because I didn't start teaching until about 10 years after I started learning it. And I had been trying to get my parents to do it because they both had a lot of stress in their lives. My father had post-traumatic stress disorder from the war, which is kind of what pushed me into Tai Chi and Qigong. I was dealing with a lot of that PTSD stress stuff. But they both eventually developed heart disease. So I was trying to get them to do this stuff, but they didn't have any validation. It's like their doctor didn't know about it, and they weren't reading about it in Reader's Digest, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And so so that frustration when these doctors were handing me all this research that nobody was hearing about made me come up with this idea of, why don't we create a media event, and then we'll use, because Tai Chi is very visual. You know, it's really a beautiful thing to videotape, to put on a television.
Yeah.
And so I thought, why don't we use that beauty of the visual image of it as a vehicle? And so we decided to create this mass event where we got everybody in the Kansas City area that we could get in touch with who practice Tai Chi to all come together and do it together on the south lawn of the Nelson Atkins Art Museum, which is a really gorgeous, beautiful, statuesque place. And so we had like 200 people spread out across the south lawn of the Nelson Atkins Museum, and we did massive media leading up to it, media work. And so on that day, media just showed up in droves. We had like three or four television stations, and then we had all the major local newspapers show up, and it got picked up by CNN. And so one of my assistant instructors that afternoon called. She said, "We were on CNN today." And I said, "How do you know?" And she said, "Because a friend of mine in Texas said I saw you on CNN today."
Wow.
And so then we started getting contacted by other Tai Chi and Qigong teachers, and so that kind of spurred it. But I think one of the things that drove me personally to, because it's really consumed most of me and my wife's life, and we've spent a lot of our life savings, you know, pulling all this together without really any immediate idea of, you know, any way that we could ever, you know, kind of recoup that that expenditure. And
right.
So it was a real daring thing. And I think the thing that kind of pushed me that way was when my mother had to go in for a angioplasty, and which is a fairly routine procedure. You know, the doctor told us they do it all the time. It's not really a big deal. But she asked all of us kids to come back to Wichita for it. And that was weird because she had been through actually a heart surgery before that was very dangerous, and she didn't ask any of us to come back for that. But for the angioplasty, she called all of us and she asked us all to come back for it. And so, you know, I almost didn't go. I was in California. I was working, had kids. I had a son. I didn't have time. But then my wife said, oh, you know, we should go if she wants us to go. So we flew and to Wichita. And so all of her kids were there. And so the night before she went in for the surgery, they rolled her down in a wheelchair and she talked to all of us and, you know, held my new son and everything. And that night I went up to her hospital room and I had a copy of the Tao Te Ching, which had always been real helpful for me, you know, learning the meditation, you know, the inner arts of Tai Chi and Qigong. And I left it with her. You know, I thought, well, you know, I'll let her read this. You know, she's got nothing else to do. And then the next day. The doctor told us that they were done. We were all going to go out and have lunch, you know, while mom recovered from her from anesthesia and everything. And the doctor walked in and he pulled his mask down and he said, we lost her. And everybody just collapsed. You know, it was just this wave of sorrow that just exploded through the room. And after we kind of recovered some, my sisters went into her hospital room to clean out her stuff. And they found that book, the Tao Te Ching, that I had loaned her. And she had written notes to her children. And she wrote a note in there to me. And she said, I wish I could go back a few years and practice the arts of relaxation Junior had tried to teach me for a healthier mind and body, because I would have so loved to see my grandchildren grow up. And so at the time, I wasn't teaching. At the time, I was just doing Tai Chi. I had just been trying to get them to do it. You know, I'd been trying to show them how to do it. And then it was 10 years later when I started teaching, and then a few years after that we got this idea of doing this mass media event. And I think, and it was interesting because right after we held that first World Tai Chi and Qigong Day, I was cleaning out my basement and I found that copy of the Tao Te Ching and I saw that note. And I realized that was kind of what had driven me to go through all the slings and arrows and the terror of investing so much of our savings into creating this global event that would educate other people around the world, because there are hundreds of millions of people around the planet that are dealing with the same stuff that my parents were. And so now, you know, like I said, my parents had no reference for it because it wasn't in Reader's Digest. Well, Reader's Digest has covered World Tai Chi and Qigong Day now.
That's like great. Wow. That's incredible. You know, you reminded me of the time when I talked to my mother and I was meeting her for a dinner. And I said, you know, come around the back of this restaurant. I want to show you an exercise. And she was kind of resistant, you know. So that never happened, you know. But it did remind me, you know. And there were so many people who could benefit from this.
Oh yeah. I'd be willing to bet that a lot of Tai Chi and Qigong teachers around the planet have had the same experience with their parents. Because the parents don't have any social reference for it. Their doctors, you know, don't know about it. And the magazines they read don't know about it. But World Tai Chi and Qigong Day, we've generated a ton of media around the world on Tai Chi and Qigong. So there's a lot of new teachers whose parents are going to be way more open to this than our parents were because
Absolutely
of, you know, the work
true.
That we've
that
all done together.
So true, so true. Okay, so you may know that I believe that we start out doing these body-mind disciplines for our own reasons, like the what's in it for me principle. And I'm not saying mm-hmm. that's bad. I'm just saying mm-hmm. that it is, whether it's stress mm-hmm. or whether it's I want to beautify my skin or whether mm-hmm. it's I want to meet somebody in Tai Chi class or whatever it is, you mm-hmm. know, or it could be stop the neck pain. But mm-hmm. Once we come out on the other side, once we have gathered some understanding of this kind of discipline, once we have gathered some strength and stability through this learning process, then I believe we can decide to direct ourselves to take some kind of action, a global action, something that's not just, mm-hmm. oh, just about me. Let's, you know, I want to get better. I want to do personal development. Me, 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 me. Mm-hmm. I believe mm-hmm. that, yes, we may, you know, that may be our habit. But I do believe that because of the massive change or the elevation that we get from doing this stuff, we get ready, mm-hmm. we get positioned to take some kind of action for world benefit.
Right.
So can you comment? This is my, and I think people are in line to make some type of peacemaking action or some kind of conflict resolution action. Please comment on that.
Well, I've actually been working on a new book for years, and I'm just a few months away from finishing it. It's called The Gospel of Science. And the way that the book opens is that I remember many, many, many years ago when I was about, 6, 7 years old or something like that. And I was sitting in my Bible school class. My parents went to the Lutheran church. And so one summer I always liked Bible school because they gave us cookies and Kool-Aid. So I remember I was sitting there in Bible school, and I was looking outside at the blue Kansas sky and those big puffy herds of those big puffy clouds going across the sky. And I remember hearing the teacher say that the gospel meant the good news, that it was good news. That's what it literally means.
Right.
And that really caught my attention because, who doesn't want to hear good news, right?
Yeah.
And so then my book, The Gospel of Science, it genesis from this, and it paints a picture of the future which runs quite counter to the way that we've been acculturated to think of the future. An alarming number of people think that the future is very dismal, but the concept and the premise in my book is that it's extremely exciting. And what I explained in there is that this good news is actually coming from science, and the science that I've been discovering over the last couple of decades is amazingly similar to the same good news that I was getting in my Sunday school classes and Bible school classes, more than you would ever think. And so I'll explain what I'm talking about here. What's happening is that mind-body practices and meditative practices are expanding across the planet at an earth-shattering speed. ABC World News reported that 40% of Americans had turned to alternative and complementary medicine, and primarily meditation. Now, what's significant about that is that over the last decades, I've immersed myself in collecting research, like you mentioned before, about mind-body practices and consciousness. And it's extremely exciting. What they've found in studies is that when people practice meditation on a regular basis, and when I say meditation, I'm talking about going into the brainwave alpha state, the alpha state brainwave state. That's indicative of a meditative state. There's a lot of different meditative ways to get there, but the way that you know that you're there is when the brain goes into the alpha wave state, and it's that state where you kind of surrender and you start to kind of drift and lose your sense of self. You don't stay there all the time when you're meditating, but you drift into it from time to time. And it has all these healing benefits. And so the reason it's spreading not only throughout the United States but around the planet so rapidly, because my global work with teachers all over the planet has shown me this is a global phenomenon. It's just not in the U.S. like ABC World News had reported. But what they're finding in this research is that most of the people are going to these mind-body meditative techniques because of health research, medical research that they're reading about it, and health issues. But the side effect that they're finding is that when people meditate on a regular basis, it increases the empathy and compassion parts of their brain. It actually physically increases the size of the empathy and compassion parts of the brain, and it shrinks the fear and stress parts of the brain. And so when people meditate, they're actually transforming themselves into more humane, empathetic, and compassionate beings. And that's what all the major religions of the world, that's the root of all the major religions of the world. Now, they can get distorted and twisted and bent in a lot of different ways, which they have from time to time. I mean, we had the Dark Ages and the Inquisitions and different things around the planet. But the essential kernel of inspiration for all these religions was compassion and empathy for your fellow human being. And so science is starting to spread meditative technologies around the planet at a mind-numbing, that's a poor word, but an incredibly accelerated pace. And what's happening is hundreds of millions of people around the planet are growing the empathy and compassion parts of their brain and shrinking the fear stress parts of their brain. And so what we're talking about is a global transformation that is more massive and altering than anything in history. The advent of democratic society, the advent of the nuclear age, anything, because we're talking about a mass of people around the planet that are starting to see the world in a whole new way, and at a time when it's most absolutely needed, because the population of the planet's quadrupled in our lifetime. No generation in the history of humanity has incurred the kind of stress that we're incurring as the planet gets more crowded, and so that's driving people more to meditation too. That stress, and what the meditation effect is it's changing our brain function in a way so that we are able to connect with other human beings in a more empathetic and compassionate way at a time when absolutely most needed in the whole history of the human race. I think it's really amazing when you start to think about this, because this stuff really just started to spread planet-wide when the Beatles went to hang out with the Maharishi in India. That's really the spark that kind of set a lot of this in motion.
Absolutely. Yeah, I remember back in the day, I sat for 5 years. I sat in the corner for 2.5 hours a day, every day, attempting. And as you said, going in and out. Most of the time, I was out. I was rarely in.
Right.
And not until I actually started Tai Chi, which was 25 years later, did I realize what I was doing when I was sitting in the corner. The very first second I did Tai Chi, I was meditating, the very first second.
Right.
But, you know, as opposed to sitting in the corner for 2.5 hours a day for 5 years, one of the things you hit upon was talking about the compassion principle and the empathy principle, and how scientific studies are showing how the brain changes because of what we're doing. And that leads me to talk about you as a novelist. Now, one would think, oh, we're going to read a Bill Douglas book, so it's probably going to be a Tai Chi manual. That's kind of what I thought when I was going to read your very first book. And that's exactly the opposite of what I got. What I got was an amazingly thrilling, wonderful plot and wonderful descriptive story, and it had to do with compassion, but that was just an underlying theme. It was there, but that wasn't the basis of the book. And the second book, you did that, and I'm so thrilled about this book coming up. And I know I should have read it. I'm going to soon. It's going to be an amazing collection of your findings and your knowledge. So do your books express your the way where you've come because of Tai Chi, or is it just where you've come as a person, or what would you say?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's everything, you know, everything that's happened all woven together, but what the novels do reflect is that this awareness that I was talking about with this nonfiction book that I'm working on right now, that I'm finishing up, The Gospel of Science, it lays it all out, in factual. It's very heavily endnoted, you know, so that you can have access to all the research and everything that I've collected over the culmination of about 20 years. But the novels, they were stories about a global awakening, and all, but how it happens on an individual basis with individual human beings, and the doubts that we have about ourselves, because when we start to see ourselves and our planet in new ways, we have a lot of doubts. It's like a lot of the media and stuff kind of pulls our minds towards consumerism and really kind of inconsequential, meaningless pursuits in our lives. And so when people start to have these personal awakenings, on the one hand, it's great. You have an illumination that's very exciting. But then you also have to deal with a lot of frustration, because while you're changing, the whole world is not. And I think one of the best series that I saw on this outside of my own novels, and just so that the listeners know, the novels you're talking about that I wrote is 2012, The Awakening, and the other one is A Conspiracy of Spirits. But there was an HBO series by Laura Dern called Enlightenment. And if any of you get a chance to see that, it's a must-see. You got to start from the beginning and see the whole two seasons. but it's about she has this epiphany. She goes to a drug rehab clinic in Hawaii, and she has this spiritual epiphany, an awakening in her mind. And then she has to go back to Southern California, back to her job, you know, in the corporate culture and everything. And so everything in her life is pulling her back away from this big awakening that she had. And so that's what the characters in my novels go through. They go through this personal struggle of seeing the world in a bigger way, but still living in a tightly constricted world. And I think everybody on the planet is dealing with that. We are all seeing that there is a bigger vision for humanity. If you read the public opinion polls, you know, people want a green, renewable energy economy. They want an economy where people, you know, get a minimum wage that they can live on, you know, and they don't have to be all stressed out. They want people to have they don't want people to suffer and struggle. It's woven within our DNA. We have an empathy gene. I actually get into that in the Gospel of Science as well. And so so my characters in my novel, I was trying to imagine or feel, well, I didn't have to stretch too far because I know what it felt like, because we're all feeling it. We're feeling a sense of seeing a bigger way to live that we can't really quite define. It's like it's unfolding on the edge of our consciousness in some illuminated way that is beyond words. We feel it really strongly with our heart that there's something bigger and better that we're headed for, but we're living in a constricted world that's defined by old definitions that are increasingly starting to kind of fall apart in a lot of ways because they don't quite work. And so anyway, that's kind of how, you know, my novels cover, they try to give the reader an opportunity to hang out with somebody who's kind of going through the same thing that they're going through so that they don't feel so alone and that they, you know, see that there are possibilities of actually letting this deeper part of ourselves unfold through our lives, even though it can be kind of frustrating at times.
I want to say at this point, if anybody gets a chance, and you should make yourself get that chance, to read 2012 Awakening or The Conspiracy of Spirits or The Coming, The Gospel of Science. I haven't read The Gospel of Science, although I am soon. It's amazing. Bill, you really are putting on the map the map of compassion. That's really what you're putting there. Nobody has really defined that. That's why it's very important work.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah. I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan, and I really do. I do encourage everyone to see, you know, look up Bill's books. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, one thing I'll add to that is earlier you were mentioning that you thought the books were entertaining, and I just wanted to share a quick story. One of my Tai Chi students is an actor named Holmes Osborne, and you've seen him in many things. He played Donnie Darko's father, and you'll see him. He was in Crazy in Alabama, and just a whole slew, Wind Talkers, a whole bunch of movies. But anyway, he was in one of my Tai Chi classes, and he hired me to prep him because he was going to be in that Tom Hanks movie where Tom Hanks played a guy that had to go back and get a college education because he was losing his job, and Julia Roberts was in it. Holmes played the administrator of the college that Tom Hanks goes to, and Tom Hanks wanted him to be a Tai Chi aficionado, his character. And so he had studied with me before, and then he hired me to consult with right before he went out to Hollywood to do the movie. And so I had just finished 2012 The Awakening. It wasn't published. It was in my computer. And I said, Holmes, I said, I've been working on a novel. I said, would you like to look at it? And, you know, and he kind of said, oh, okay. You know, actors, they get handed novels all the time. He didn't really want it. And so anyway, I printed it out. And right before he took off for L.A., I handed it to him. And when he got to L.A., a couple of days after he got to L.A., he called me up and he goes, holy crap. He goes, that is one hell of a novel.
You know? Right. You're talking about Larry Crown, by the way, right? The movie Larry Crown.
Yeah, Larry Crown. That's right. Yeah, and he said, I'm going to give a copy of this to Tom Hanks. And he did, but I don't think Tom ever read it. So.
Well, you know, we have busy lives. You never know. But I am certain by your putting this nonfiction book after your first two books, which were completely entertaining. I couldn't put them down. I could not put either of them down. Anyway, so
we know. Ravi Shalaman is the, you know, she's the heroine in 2012 of The Awakening, the woman that's going through this personal awakening. And
right.
Anyway, when I first started working on this nonfiction book, The Gospel of Science, I kept getting this feeling in the back of my head that this is the book that Ravi, this is the nonfiction book that Ravi would have written if she would have written a book about what she, you know, about what she was seeing happening on
right.
the planet.
Right, 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 right. No, it looked like, it felt like a lot of you, you know. I mean, the whole thing was you, but it felt like. Okay, so I have last question. What is the biggest obstacle that you see that's in the way of peaceful conflict resolution or an awakening for mm-hmm. for the corporate world? What is the biggest obstacle mm-hmm. in the way? And mm-hmm. yeah, what's the biggest obstacle?
Yeah, it's human consciousness. You know, when you get down to everything, it's all, you know, you look outside the window right now and almost everything you see, you know, I mean, not the trees and plants, but almost everything else is, it came from, you know, an engineer's mind or a civic planner's mind or a visionary's mind or whatever. So in the modern world, the modern developed world, almost everything is the product of human consciousness. So where we're going to be in 20 years is going to depend on the synaptic electrical firing that's going on within human consciousness right now. And so as mind-body tools are expanded across the planet through corporate wellness and through, you know, healthcare and everything, what's happening is that there's epiphanies, there's these awakenings that are starting to bubble through the consciousness of individual minds all over the planet. And now what's exciting about that, beyond that, is that I did a presentation for Folsom Prison, maximum security prison, the one that Johnny Cash played at in California. And when I went there, I thought that I was going to be introducing them to Tai Chi and Qigong meditation. But that wasn't the case. Judith Trethway and an inmate there named Jim, they had actually started a Tai Chi Cha program 2 years before. So they'd been practicing mind-body meditation for 2 years. And so I went through all the, you know, slamming steel doors, and it gets pretty intense. And you have to sign a waiver saying if you get taken as a hostage, they won't negotiate for your release.
Right.
So anyway, I got all the way into the middle of the prison, and there's a chapel in the middle of the prison, and I walked in there. And in the prison, it's all segregated. It's like whites hang out with whites, blacks hang out with blacks, Hispanics hang out with Hispanics, and, you know, and there's a lot of conflicts that happen between those groups. And you have to go in. Like, if you're white, you got to hang out with white guys, even if you don't, you know, even if you're an egalitarian human being, if you want to survive, you got to do that. But when I got into the chapel where the Tai Chi Qigong meditation group was, it was all integrated. There were Native Americans in there. There were Hispanics. There were blacks. There were whites. There was, you know, everything. And they were all doing, yeah, they were all flowing through these Tai Chi Cha, and some of them were sitting in the pews and they were meditating, you know. And I found out they'd been doing this for 2 years. And this inmate named Jim, after it was over, I started talking to him, and I communicated with him for quite a while after that. And he had kept statistics over these 2 years. And what they found was that not only did the recidivism rate and the behavioral incident rate improve dramatically for the people in the Tai Chi and Qigong meditation group, but they improved for the whole prison over these 2 years. And so that jived with other research that I'd been collecting. There was a fairly well-known study in Washington, D.C., where the TM Foundation had brought in meditators. They collaborated with the police chief of the Washington, D.C. Police Department, this crime statistics department, and some universities. And they told them, we want to bring in a certain number of meditators, and we're planning on a result being that your crime rate will drop by, I think it was like 25% or something like that. And so anyway, the police chief laughs, and he goes, yeah, he goes, you'll do that if there's a blizzard in August, because that's when they were going to do it. And so anyway, he agreed, you know, and the crime statistics department worked with him. And what was amazing was that not only did they bring down the HRI, which is homicides rates and assaults rate, for that percentage that they had predicted that they would, but they actually dropped it a little bit more than they had predicted that they would. Now, the thing that was really amazing about it was they didn't bring all the meditators in at once. They brought them in progressively. And if you look at the lines on the chart, the drop in crime matches the increase in meditators coming into the city. And it's a very small percentage.
No doubt. That's fantastic. I'm so not, I'm not surprised, you know. That's amazing.
Yep.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so this is so what's happening all over the planet with meditation being spread all over the planet is it's not only affecting the people that are doing it, but it's affecting the population around those people.
Absolutely.
And I don't know if we're going to have time later, but I want to talk about a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, because everybody needs to read it, because this is part of my Gospel of Science book as well, because what it shows is that the planet Earth is less violent today than at any time in history, and I know that'll stun a lot of people, so I'll explain it more if we have more time at any point.
Yeah, well, you know what? Why don't you talk about it? Give us the title again. I mean, we're at the end. Okay. This is what I have planned.
Diane, Bill, it's Steve. We can add some time to this, so if Bill wants to discuss that, I certainly say let's do it.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
Okay.
Well, great. Yeah, we can. I wanted to. I have just my ending and some questions that people have given to me. So please give us the name of that book again and talk about it.
Okay. Yeah, it's called The Better Angels. It's called The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinker. Steven Pinker is a Harvard psychologist, and it's a huge book, but I highly recommend it. It'll change the way you see the world. And what he did was he compiled all the statistical data from, you know, the earliest history of humanity, you know, because they have all these forensic records of, you know, these people that you see in the natural history museums, you know, the ancient primordial human beings. And when you look at all this data in totality, what you find is that the planet, like I said, the planet Earth is less violent today than it has been at any time in human history, and not just by a little bit, massively less violent than at any time in human history. Now, what's even more exciting, because, you know, when I discovered this book, I started doing a lot of research on this. What's even more exciting is it seems to be accelerating, because crime rates are dropping all over the planet. In most of the planet, crime rates are dropping precipitously, and over the last two decades, they've dropped profoundly. Just in the last decade or so, the homicide rate in the United States has dropped by half, and it was already tremendously low, you know, as far as like historical records were concerned. So there's something happening across the face of the planet, and nobody can explain it. In my Gospel of Science book, I have a quote from a professor who says, you know, nobody understands why this is happening. It's happening, and, you know, some people will say, now, Steven Pinker's book is very meticulous about going through history and explaining how social changes can address some of this stuff, and it's brilliant. I couldn't improve on that at all. But coming from the mind-body meditative angle and knowing what I know about the mind-body meditative practices and the effects that they have, the changing effects in the brain where they cause people to become more their brains to become larger in the empathy and compassion areas and smaller in the fear and stress parts. For me, coming from that angle and seeing the rapid decline in our time, just in the last few decades, of violent crimes, I'm seeing it as something deeper than just sociological changes. I'm seeing it as something that's happening within the consciousness of human beings all over the planet, and I think that meditators are accelerating this, but it's not just affecting them, because as we just talked about, these studies show that these consciousness changes are you know, our minds are like radios. I mean, they're, you know, brain waves don't just
absolutely
stop at the skull. Yeah,
that's said very well. Absolutely true.
Yes. Yeah. So they're rippling out. You know, these waves are rippling out all through society.
What you said is, yes, I all of these things that you've talked about, you have delineated so well. I'm so very excited, you know, that you were able to talk about this stuff, because I know it to be, but the way that you set it out there, and the way that you write, that's going to be a wonderful thing. I'm, you know, and I certainly want to help get it in the hands of as many people as possible.
Well, that's really what led me to, that was the big impetus to write the Gospel of Science, was to shatter this illusion in the world that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, because the most powerful prophecy, you know, a lot of people think that it's gonna, you know, everything's gonna be over because of some prophecy that they read, you know, and it could be any kind. There's all kinds of prophecies out there, but what I opened the book with is on the cover of the book, is I say the most powerful prophecy is the self-fulfilling prophecy. because the state of our consciousness is what is creating the world of the future. And so the book takes two tacks. It shatters the illusion that the world is worse than it was before, because anybody that sits in front of the TV screen and watches the news on a daily basis, they think everything is very dangerous. They think their fellow human beings are cutthroats and that they're very dangerous, and it's getting more so. But I tell my students, I say, you know, those cameras are being drawn to the most violent points on the planet. Now, there's nothing wrong with knowing about that, because that's one of the things that gives us an impetus to even make the planet even less violent. So it's not like it's wrong, but it's a distortion, and we have to come to terms with the fact that we are living in a really, you know, a lot of times people long for the good old days. The point of my book is, these are the good old days, right,
right
here and right now.
You know,
it's not going to get any better than this, and it's going to get way better than it is. And so the book does, it tries to unlock that myth that the world is getting worse, and it opens up a whole new awakening that the future is tremendously and profoundly exciting. And as minds become aware of the fact that the planet is safer than it's ever been before, and meditation continues to shrink the fear stress parts of the brain, what will happen is we won't operate in this terror mode that we operate in, where I've just been seeing these news reports about how the police departments all over the United States have been militarized, where they're bringing all this military equipment back from Afghanistan and Iraq, and they're arming the police departments with these war machines, these anti-tank resistant war machines, and these turrets where they have snipers up on top of them, where they can point guns at people on the street. And it makes the idea that the citizenry is an occupied nation, and it's not a good healthy thing for society. And it's being driven because of people's fear. It's like we're willing to spend these massive amounts of money on a militarized police force. And also, if you look around the world, the United States, we spend a tremendous amount of money on weaponry. But if you look around the world, countries spend way too much on weaponry as opposed to programs of social uplift and education and these kind of things. And so as people become more increasingly aware of the fact that they're safe, they don't have to fear this. The planet is safer than it's ever been, and it's just going to get safer and safer. Then what happens is it changes the whole direction of our future, because all of a sudden the resources that we once used to create a militarized nation start flowing into preschool teachers and school teachers and meditation teachers and, you know.
Right, right. So you think Diane? Way... Yes.
Do I have permission to ask a question?
Yes,
you're
hosting.
Yes.
Thank you. This leads to a question I have for Bill, and I think that you're going to agree with this. My name is Steve. I'm the co-producer of the World Stage, and we have affiliates in, I guess, 150 some nations for the big event in November. You mentioned something that really, really intrigued me and fascinated me. Regarding the fact that the media is just showing all this tragedy that's going on, whether it's in Missouri, whether it's the downed airlines, it's almost like the scandal of the week. I mean, have we forgotten what happened to the Malaysian airline? But at the same time, while there's conflict in Israel and Gaza, I was on the phone today with a woman who left Tel Aviv to come to America. She has a property in Israel, and she's opened an office in New York. And there's a lot of love going on in these communities, too. I think when we look at the media and you look at who buys the advertising, the media is almost forced to create conflict to get people to feel that they need to consume as opposed to just be present and not consume. This mass consumption is creating most of the problems, whether it's the military-industrial complex, whether it's the education system, which is extremely problematic. And I think if we go back to in the 60s, where I have a lot of friends that were involved in the quote-unquote Woodstock hippie hair movement, there was a lot of them just dropped out of the scene and wound up becoming the people that they hated. But But I think now with the communications that we have, where we can email, chat, discuss, collaborate, create, we are at this really, really exciting time. And what I'd love to talk to Bill about, I know this is a long intro, and that's, as Diane could attest, sometimes that's my biggest fault, is get to the point. But I had to preface it with some stuff. I think that one of the things that we're doing at the World Sage is actually we're shedding the light on possibilities for the planet by showing people that are doing things that are that others aren't talking about that are really good for the planet. Because the media thrives on people buying stuff. Most media channels are created to sell advertising. So my question is, how do we get the people who are already involved with this movement, mind, body, soul, heart, tai chi, yoga, natural eating, wellness, to actually co-create a global movement to take this to a higher level? Because it's fabulous to hear that we're more peaceful now than we were before. I did not know that.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Stephen. Okay, Bill, go ahead. Solve the world.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I think I kind of get into this in the book somewhat, in the Gospel of Science, is that this is going to be what's happening, this transformation that's already sweeping the planet and already having the impact that you just alluded to, which is the planet's becoming less violent, or at least in my opinion, that's a huge contributor to it. Is that it'll be, and my novels kind of get to this as well, is that it's going to be a very organic thing. It's going to bubble up in a way that's going to be different than organized social or political movements of the past, because it's going to bubble up in the consciousness of human beings. So, like, we're involved in this radio production right now that is going to ripple out, and it's going to affect and impact people. But there are other people all over, you know, we all experience this, you know, through the internet or whatever, you know, there's websites, there's news groups, there's all kinds of blogs, there's ways that people are connecting that have this desire for this, this whole new way of approaching our place in the world, you know, with a healing touch. And we see it just bubbling up on a massive scale, and it's bubbling up in a way where it can't really be derailed. You know, like in the 60s, you had, you may be aware of COINTELPRO, where a lot of the progressive movements like Martin Luther King's work and Southern Christian Leadership Conference and all these kind of things, they were like sabotaged and kind of, you know, there was efforts to try to make them fall apart. Well, the way that this new wave of change is coming is that can't happen because it's all bubbling up in so many different ways. It's like the Dutch boy can't put his finger in the dike. And so the possibilities of this are really tremendous. So it feels like it can feel kind of like it's not happening because it's so nebulous. And, you know, and those of us that want something more organized, you can kind of feel a doubt that it's happening, but we see the evidence. You know, in Steven Pinker's book, you see the evidence the planet's getting less violent. Now, having said that, in my book, The Gospel of Science, I have a chapter towards the end about how, because as you practice these techniques, your empathy and compassion parts of your brain are going to get bigger, and you're going to feel, also the other thing that the research showed is that not only do people's empathy and compassion parts of the brain get bigger, but when they showed them images of people suffering, the action parts of their brain stimulated more. So not only were they more empathetic with that person suffering, but they were pushed to take some kind of an action. And so I have a chapter in the book where I talk about that, how as we practice these techniques, we're going to be driven more to want to alleviate suffering, and it's going to be irritating. You know, it's going to make us feel discombobled. The Dalai Lama said that the tears of compassion feed the well of hope. And so, you know, we don't like crying. It's discomforting, but it's feeding something because we're being pushed. And so in that chapter, what I talk about is ways that we can use the internet. The internet it's a new thing. It's kind of been going through its adolescence in our lifetime, you know, where it's been like shopping and pornography and, you know, just different distracting things like that. And now I think we're getting to a stage where it's starting to mature. And what it is people are starting to, they're starting to get an inkling that we can use the internet as a way to connect people all over the planet that have a larger vision of possibility. And so it's like, you know, any given day when I sit down in front of the computer, I've got petitions that I can sign and then put on my Facebook page and my Twitter page, you know, for a cleaner environment or to help somebody that's suffering from some kind of human rights abuse somewhere on the planet or different things like that. And so the internet will give us a huge vehicle to organize people of like mind. And so programs like this radio program that we're involved in right now, you know, are bubbling up throughout the all of humanity, and these things are going to, I mean, we've seen huge changes just in the last 10 years. We've seen huge changes towards, you know, people becoming more compassionate, more concerned about the environment and things like that. And I think this is just going to escalate. So I really do feel like we're, you know, things are happening right now, and
right,
they're going to continue
right.
to happen, but it's nebulous. I can't really describe exactly how
right.
it's all going to unfold.
That's a great description, because we know, I mean, we're involved in this, so we know, we see these changes. We feel the changes mm-hmm. first, and then we see them spreading out to others.
Right.
So
that's a good point.
Now, I have a bunch of questions, but before I give other people's questions, I want to give listeners one action step that they can take. So for you, I'm going to ask you for a two-part action step.
Mm-hmm.
If you could give people one action step that they could take to create peaceful harmony in themselves, what would that action
mm-hmm.
step be?
Meditate daily. Meditate, and when you meditate daily, don't try to focus on anything. Try to let go. Let go of everything that you are, everything. Let yourself free fall. Every time you let a breath out, just let yourself just exhale and let your whole being exhale. Let your brain exhale. Let go of everything you think, everything you believe, everything that you hold on to. Because in those moments of absolute letting go, there's a newness that's just waiting to expand through us. And it'll play out in our lives in ways that we can't even begin to imagine at this point. But we have to ungrip and unglue on a regular basis, because this newness, it's waiting to come through us. It's like we're vortexes. It's coming at us, and we have to breathe and relax and let go of everything that we are, everything that we believe on a regular basis, so that there's space for it to come rushing through us and expanding out into this new world that we're creating.
That's brilliant, brilliant. Yeah, today, my today's article, my main essay for warriorsofweight.com was about the habit of meditation. But what you just said mm-hmm. means that I have to do another article about it, because you just said it way better than I had expressed it. But just that free fall thing, bam. Wonderful. Okay, so the second part of this is, what action step could people take once or regularly to create peaceful harmony in the world? I mean, you know,
well,
so we know that we have evolved ourselves from this body-mind stuff. So what one action can we do on a regular basis, or just once? Because some people don't want to commit to regularly,
mm-hmm.
but, you know.
Well, yeah, well, I have two. One is, use the internet as an organizing tool, as an action tool. You know, sign petitions, pass petitions on. You know, create a Facebook and Twitter, and, you know, form groups of like-minded people with your focus being, you know, healing things and just passing these things on. Because, you know, it's like in the Gospel of Science book, I do an equation that if we pass some petition on that was going to help somebody or change the environmental policies or something, and we sent that out to 50 people, and then those 50 people sent it out to 50 people, I think within about four or five sendings, it would be that politician or that public official or that corporate news agency would have like a couple of million letters on their desk, you know, and that shakes people. That shakes people when they open their inbox and they've got 2 million emails asking them something, you know, demanding something.
Right, right. Okay,
so that's one. That's one thing. But the other thing that I wanted to say real quickly, and, you know, like I said, the chapter in the Gospel of Science, it details how you can become an internet activist, because I've spent decades doing that myself, and so just like with World Tai Chi Day, I pass on in the book how I did it, so that make it easier for you to do it. But then the other thing too is, you know, just like all the spiritual traditions have told us, you know, whoever it is that God puts in front of us, you know, it's as we go through our days, you know, whoever it is that God puts in front of us, or that the universal consciousness or whatever, however you want to perceive it, you know, or existence or whatever, whoever it places in front of us, they're a child of God. And it's like It's like that's when, you know, if when we support, you know, when we're kind to that person, we're being kind to the universal creator. You know, it's the way of the world.
Cool. Very good. Very good. All right. So before I do my outro, I'm going to ask you some questions. I have a question from a grandmaster in Northern California. How do we spread Tai Chi peacefulness to masses of people without form instruction?
Without form instruction?
Yeah, without form. Yeah, not teaching the form or not teaching.
Oh, not teaching Tai Chi. Well, I think we can do both because my Tai Chi teacher, she always said something that really struck with me. She said one of the really beautiful things about Tai Chi is that, like, when you do yoga, you're preparing the body to go into that higher meditative state, right?
Okay.
That's kind of the goal of yoga. Well, with Tai Chi, we always did our Nei Gong or sitting Qigong meditation. We always went into the meditative states at the beginning of the class, and then we brought it into our moving Qigong warm-ups. They became like meditations, and then our Tai Chi forms, of course, are meditations. And so my teacher said what is so unique about Tai Chi is that it's designed to take the higher meditative states and ground them into our physical being and our physical world. And so I think there's a real powerful place for Tai Chi. And so I do advocate expanding Tai Chi as much as possible. But, of course, you know, just teaching people to meditate is, you know, teaching people how to breathe and let go and kind of allow space for that lightness or that chi or life energy to expand through. That can be a really powerful tool, too. So I'll do corporate workshops where I don't really teach Tai Chi as much as I just teach them, you know, Qigong breathing and how to just kind of ungrip and open and lighten. So to that grandmaster, I think we should do both. I think we should be expanding Tai Chi as widely as we possibly can. But we can also modify what we teach so that it will fit into different places, you know, kind of be all things to all men kind of thing.
Okay, that's great. So I'm going to modify what she said a little bit. So to spread the peacefulness that we get from Tai Chi, so your answer is meditate every day and sign petitions and start groups and meet with people of like mind. Is that kind of it?
Yeah,
I mean, no,
you know,
as a first step. Of course, I'm simplifying everything.
Yeah, no, I'm agreeing with everything that you just said. I was just going to expand on that. Yeah,
okay.
I do think that the like I was saying, I think the meditation is the most important part of this, and I get into this in the Gospel of Science. The reason that the meditation is such an important part of it is because, you know, over most of my adult life, I've been an activist, human rights, environmental, and different things like that, and I actually did it professionally for years. What I've found is that when I'm an activist and I neglect my meditation, I'm running really hard, but I'm not getting anywhere. It's like I can put a lot of effort into things, you know. But with meditation, it's like it simplifies everything. And so then it's like you can take, you know, it's like with Tai Chi. You know, Tai Chi, it's real high engineering when you do it for a few years, you start to realize what it is.
Yeah.
Is it's about using the least amount of effort to get the maximum amount of effect. And so when we immerse ourselves in meditation on a regular basis, we clarify the consciousness. We let go of everything that we think we're supposed to be or do or whatever. And then we let kind of a newness lilt up. There was in my book, I quote a psychoneuroimmunologist who said, she said that prayer is to talk to God, meditation is to listen. And so it's like when we go into these meditative states, we let go of everything that we are. We free fall into emptiness. And then what happens is these whispers of possibility kind of start to come into our lives. And we just kind of get drawn to actions or things that will have the most impact. And also, I think the other thing about being a political activist is one of the things that I've, over the years, is that I've often fallen into is that I would get really angry when people wouldn't see what it was that I was seeing.
Right.
You know, and a lot of times you'll kind of rub people the wrong way. And all that retards everything. It retards evolution and progress because the more we irritate somebody who doesn't see the bigger picture, the more it entrenches them into gripping onto that way of seeing things. the more humane and the more accepting we can be of everybody. And I'm, you know, this is a work in process. I'm not saying I've got it all. I'm not perfect at this. But the thing is, when I meditate on a regular basis, when I immerse myself in meditation, I find ways to approach these things that are less irritating to the people that don't see the bigger picture. And in that way, I don't make them enemies. In that way, I kind of become a supporter of theirs, you know, kind of helping things evolve into another way. So, it's, you know, Tai Chi is a great model for this because you learn how to let things flow through you in a very effortless way, and you become much more powerful because of it. So you're not straining, you know, you're not tightening and straining and forcing. You're relaxing and breathing and flowing. And like Lao Tzu said, you know, in doing nothing, all things are done, kind of an attitude.
That's great. Good way of putting it. Fantastic. Okay, next question, anonymous from Los Angeles. What do you think Tai Chi and Qigong can do for a war that is in progress?
Well, the more we can get meditation into every place, you know, whether people are at war or whatever, the better. When you're in the grips of things like that, it's a pretty acute state. When people are locked in the fear, that's a really tough row to hoe. It's easier to get meditation into places where there's a lull. You know, it's like the planet is kind of like ocean waves. You know, it's like an angry wave will build up, and then it'll pass, and then there will be a lull. And the lulls are the places where we can get. Where we can kind of be most effective, I think, as you know, as far as spreading meditation and Tai Chi and Qigong and things like this. Now, in the case of the United States, it's a little different because when we're involved in a war, we're not really involved in a war. There's just a few poor kids who join the military. A lot of them so that they could get a college education who are actually in the war. Most of us aren't in the war. So by spreading meditation and Tai Chi and Qigong and these things through the United States as widely as we possibly can, it, you know, like we've talked about before, it's going to ripple out and change the consciousness of everybody, and the fear stress parts of their brain will shrink. And the more they shrink, the less fear we'll see in the world. And the less fear we see in the world, the less likely that we'll have that reflex where we automatically respond with a military solution. And so so in the United States, it's a little different because we have a lull where we can have space to do that. But in smaller countries where they're actually feeling the effects and they're hearing the bombs and they're feeling things explode and they're seeing, you know, corpses, that's a pretty tough road to hoe to try to use this stuff in those kinds of situations. I'm not saying that it wouldn't be a good thing. But I'm just saying, I think we'll be more effective if we try to operate in the places where there's a lull to the maximum of our ability.
Okay. And let's see. This is from Andrea in Rhode Island. Is it better to do Tai Chi when you have your energy in the morning when you wake up, or after you've experienced all the stress of the day?
Well, you know, the Tai Chi masters that I've talked to over the years, they've all advocated morning. And when I first started teaching Tai Chi 20 years ago, I had to teach almost all my classes in the evening because most people, the baby boomers were all working back then. But
right.
Now what's happened over the last few years is because the baby boomers have started retiring, all my classes are now morning classes. I don't teach any evening classes. I refuse to teach an evening class. Because I realized when I heard those Chinese masters talking about that morning energy and how important it was to do in the morning, I thought it was superstition. You know, a lot of times we think these things are superstition until we do it for 20 years and then we realize,
right.
Oh, yeah, that wasn't, it
yep.
was real. And it is real because those yep. morning classes that I teach, God, they are so much easier to teach than those evening classes when people were all stressed out from traffic and work and all that kind of stuff. And but having said that, you know, sometimes for myself personally, I do like to do Tai Chi in the evening because it kind of helps me untangle the stuff that I've picked up that day.
Right.
So
right.
But you may have done it
in the morning as well.
Yeah, the morning's the optimum time.
Yep.
And so that's what I advocate to everybody, but there's no I think it's good to do it in the evening as well.
Mm-hmm.
I avoid teaching in the evening. For teachers, I suggest if you can get classes going in the morning.
Oh, I know. I'm always looking for those 6 and 7 a.m. classes myself, always. How often would you suggest, and now I'm not talking about somebody who's new, how often would you suggest and for how long is it recommended? How long would you?
You mean meditation or?
No, I'm talking about Tai Chi.
Oh, okay. Well, my Tai Chi long form is about 20 minutes that I do. Now, sometimes I'll do the right style and the left style, so I can get, you know, into like 40 minutes if I do it, both of them. So I do that. But with my beginning students, I tell them to just, when they're practicing, because they only know a few moves in the beginning, I tell them when they're practicing, just practice as long as it feels good to you. And when it starts not feeling good to you, or you just feel like you don't want to do it anymore, then don't do it, and then you can just come back and you can do it several times a day as long as you don't push it too hard. Now, I deal with a lot of people that have, like, you know, arthritis and problems like mm-hmm. that as well. So I'm always telling people to listen to their bodies. And so that, you know, that slowness about Tai Chi and, you know, being in your body, you can really be cognizant of that. And so I tell people to just do it as long as it's fun, because if you keep it fun, you'll want to keep coming back to it. If you push yourself, you know, because when I first started doing Tai Chi, I would kind of push myself into these kind of masochistic, you know, things where I would, you know, I would want to be the dude who could hold a stress position longer than any of the other dudes, because I wanted to be really, you know, a tough dude. Right. And over time, I realized I just trained myself to hate standing post, you know, or gathering chi or whatever you call it, universal post. You know, I just trained myself to hate it, and I stopped doing it for years because it was just, every time I thought of it, I just thought, oh, that sounds horrible, you know. And so now, if I do the universal post, I just do it as long as it feels good to me. You know, I don't push it past that, and that's how I kind of approach it with my students, because then you always want to come back and play.
Okay, that's great. Now, this is from Danielle from Ohio. Was World Tai Chi Day well received around the world? And was there one location that was a greater challenge than most to catch on?
I've been pretty much amazed. Now, most of the events are in the United States because that's where I'm located.
Yep.
So if you looked at a world map, you'd see most of them are in the United States, but they're all over the world. Now it's been hard getting them in China, and that was disappointing. And I've actually traveled to China and met with teachers and tried to expand it more in there. Now Hong Kong has had big events for many years. Hong Kong really embraced it, and then Macau had their first event last year as well. So, but those are kind of like they're part of China, but they're kind of
that's great.
Yeah. So Hong Kong really embraced it, and they've had massive events. They had an event where I think it was like a couple thousand people in Victoria Park all doing Tai Chi.
Right.
It was great.
Right.
And so different places like Brazil has totally embraced it. When I went to Brazil for World Tai Chi Day, the Brazilian government actually flew me and Angie down there years ago. Because they made it part of their capital's 50th anniversary. They made, because it happened during the week of World Tai Chi Day. So World Tai Chi Day, they integrated it into their celebrations. And so they flew me and Angie down so that we could come and you know, give a little speech during the event. And so that was really cool. Brazil had totally embraced World Tai Chi and Qigong Day, you know, as much as the United States. It's celebrated all over Brazil. And I realized when I got down there the reason that is, and that's because Brazilians love to get together and party.
Right,
and,
exactly.
And so,
exactly,
you know,
right.
Tai Chi is a great party, you know.
And they also, it's one of the states in Brazil also made Tai Chi Day like an official day, like a regulation.
Actually, it was the National Congress of Brazil. It was the National Congress. And Jose Milton is a Tai Chi teacher down there who's a student of Master Wu in Brasilia, the capital of Brazil. And they're the ones that got that to happen. And they actually did a Tai Chi presentation for the Brazilian Congress right there in the halls of it's there. We have photos of it on the worldtaichiday.org website. And it's really quite an amazing photograph. Yeah.
That's great.
And 22 U.S. governors have proclaimed World Tai Chi and Qigong Day. The Senates of New York, the Senate of California, and the Senate of Puerto Rico, and different officials in different countries around the world.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah. I mean, every time when I go to the city, my little city, or when I go to the governor, when I reach out to the governor of my state,
mm-hmm.
I think people there get excited almost because of it. They get excited that,
yeah,
this is happening. They may not participate, mm-hmm. although this year I got more participants from the city or employees than I have before. But, you know, it takes their time.
Yeah, Boca Raton, you guys have gotten a lot of proclamations in Boca Raton.
Last question from outside. How important are the specific movements to healing someone's stress? That's from Anonymous in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in my classes, I'll get students, in my hospital classes, and I'll get students that'll say, you know, which of these moves is best for my condition, or, you know, whatever it is that I'm dealing with. And what I tell them is, and what I always tell them is all of it. It's a all thing. And what I realized over these 30 years of practicing Tai Chi and Qigong, because I really immersed myself in Chinese or Eastern philosophy, you know, Zen and you know, Taoism and all these kind of things. And what I realized is that the Eastern approach is to see things as an integrated whole. Like the body, for example, holistic medicine, it's seeing the body as an integrated whole. Whereas in the West, we break everything down. It's like we want to analyze, we want to break things down as small as possible. So when I first started teaching through the state hospital program, we were having classes for people with heart disease. We had a class for people with MS. We had a class for people with Parkinson's. We had a class for people with chronic pain and so on and so forth. And so they were saying, okay, now how are these classes different? And I said, well, they're not, because the Chinese, when they created these things, it was a holistic thing. So you practice this holistic process of you know, Tai Chi and Qigong. And as you go through it, it goes to the root of all of our health systems, and it boosts the immune system, it lowers depression, it stabilizes BNP levels for the heart, you know, it does all these different things. So I'm teaching the same thing in all these classes. And that just fried their brains, because they want things to be categorized. It has to be different for everything. And so what I did was I started changed the classes was that when we do the intellectual discussion part at the beginning of the class, I'll discuss heart disease and I'll discuss the Tai Chi and Qigong medical research on how it helps the heart. But then when we get to the actual exercises, the exercises are exactly the same for all my classes.
Right.
Because the whole process is the integrative process of all the Tai Chi and Qigong movements that gives you all the benefits. And so it's no isolated part, but I think that the big key to a successful Tai Chi and Qigong practice to really get the deepest benefits from it is when you let your mind, you practice letting your mind let go of control. And then you just start to let the motions just kind of flow through you. They almost massage you as they flow through
Absolutely.
You, and you're breathing full breaths and letting it flow through. Now, the only way that you can get there, and you know that as well, Diane, is just by doing it thousands and thousands of times. There's no secret intellectual trick. A lot of times students think, well, tell me that special intellectual trick that's going to make me get this. And I go, it ain't there. There's nothing there. You just have to do it 10,000 times.
That's it.
And enjoy it.
And then
it grows inside
you. Yeah. Yeah,
boys and girls, we have about 5 minutes left.
Okay, I'm just going to do, I'm going to do my, okay, that's great, Bill. That's fantastic. All right, I have my two secret questions. First one is, what's your favorite kind of music?
Oh, that's a tough one. That's a tough one because I like Johnny Cash. I like Kurt Cobain. I like them all. You know, I mean, I do like really soothing. I like Enya. You know, and that kind of music, but Beatles, of course, that's a tough one. I can't really say one.
Okay, that's good enough. Great. Okay, my last secret question is, how would you want people to remember you?
He did his best.
All right, that's great. Okay, that's about all the time we have. So the contact information for Bill Douglas. He can be found at worldtaichiday.org, which has a wealth of information, including the school directory, medical research, information about books. Now, to check out Bill's books, I have the URL is 2012theawakening-thenovel.com. That's where you can find, you know, the old one.
Another one is illuminationcorporation.com.
Ah, okay. All right. I tried that. I couldn't find that. I looked for that first. All right. I want to say again, those books are amazing. Go read them. All right, everyone. Thank you for listening. And, Bill, I want to say thank you so, so much for being here. Now, before we close, we hope you will take one action because of this interview. That's what it's for. One idea acted upon at the right time can change your life and that of everyone around you. Run with one today. This is Diane Gold at Peace with Diane Gold, wishing you great success and lots of love, and I will see you soon. Take care. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.